Okay, so the next panel we have is the view from the inside, decision-making in the basement. The idea of this session is for you to get a taste of how the sausage is made. We talked about Hebrew National. This is going to be a Q&A session, more or less. What we're going to do is, in lieu of passing up index cards, if you have a question, please email it to info@bethdin.org. That's info@bethdin.org. I'll get the questions here on this laptop and convey it to the panel. Again, info@bethdin.org. Once again, Benjamin Kamenetsky, I'm president of the Basin of America, partner Davis Polk. What I'm going to start out by doing is ask each of the panelists what their role is at the Basin and how they got involved in the Basin of America. And that way you can be introduced to our panelists as they answer the first question.
Okay, thank you, Benjamin. My name is Shlomo Weissman. I serve as the Menahel, the director of the Beis Din of America. I've been in that role since 2008. And my day-to-day responsibility is that I kind of oversee the operation. I field various legal, halachic issues that come up in the course of Dinei Torah and the course of the other matters that we handle. We also do Gittin. We do status determinations, people who are looking for confirmation and for certification of their Jewish status, and other halachic personal status issues. And I also occasionally sit on cases. And I think the other part was, how did I get involved in this? I started in private practice. I completed smicha at YU law school, and then I was in private practice for about 7 years doing commercial real estate law. And then when I heard that Rabbi Reis was leaving the Beis Din, that sounded like a much more interesting job than the job that I had. And so I applied for the job, and ever since then I've been thrilled to be a part of this very, very important and wonderful organization.
I'm Rabbi Itamar Rosenzweig. I edit the Jewish Prudence page at the Beis Din, which we just started publishing recently, so you could check it out on your free time. The purpose of Jurisprudence is to publish some of the Beis Din's decisions to increase transparency and just to educate the public about what goes on at the Beis Din and what kinds of cases we have and how halacha is applied in the contemporary marketplace. I'll also sometimes sit on some of the Dinei Torah at the Beis Din, and I got involved mostly first as being a member of the Dayanus Kolel at YU, where Reis would often give chaburas at the Kolel. And it occurred to me then that one of the most exciting spaces where Choshen Mishpat is being applied today and where you'll get a better analytic interpretation of where halacha is applied and how to refine the core fundamental principles of even just Seder Nezikin is at the Beis Din, where these principles are being applied on a day-to-day basis.
You already heard about my background. I also worked as an attorney at the law firm of Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton in New York. And I very much enjoyed my work as an attorney, but I was also an ordained rabbi. And I felt frustrated that I was doing all of the sophisticated legal transactions without being able to bring in my Talmudic training and my rabbinic training. And I really wanted to be able to apply the Jewish legal system to my day-to-day legal profession. And I thought that it would be ideal to be involved in Jewish jurisprudence. I just wasn't sure what the job opportunity would extend itself for that purpose. So at one point, I decided I would start learning for a more advanced smicha in the Yadin Kolel at YU. And I was actually studying with a chavusa at Cleary Gottlieb. And we would study all the material. We would get recordings of all the chaburos. And we took all of the tests, and we did very well in all the tests. And we found that at the end of the year, we were the only two members of the kol who took the tests on time. We had to meet every 100 other deadlines, so we learned to be very disciplined. So we had another 101st deadline that we had to meet, and we did. And then I realized the only way I would be able to pursue that degree would be to take a leave of absence. I had to ask the head of my practice group, I was doing corporate real estate at the time, to take a leave of absence, but I wanted to be guaranteed a place back. I didn't think I would have a different job at the end of the year. So the day that I was supposed to go for the meeting with that partner, I left my apartment. I was living on the Upper West Side in 66th Street at that time, and I had was walking to the subway station, the corner of 66th Street and Broadway, and I came across Rabbi Professor Michael Boyd at the time, who was serving as the interim director of the Beth Din of America. He's still a law professor at Emory University, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, I'm going to be taking over the Beth Din of America as the interim director for 1 year. So that's why I'm in town. What are you doing? So I said, I'm working at Cleary Gottlieb, but I have a meeting with the head of my practice group today to ask for a leave of absence so I can learn in the other yodin call at YU. So he said, I'm going to be learning there next year in the mornings. You want to be my chavrusa? I said, sure. Then he said, and do you want to also help me out to do some volunteer work and be my assistant at the Beth Din of America in the afternoon? And I said, sure. Can I say to the partner that I'm meeting with that I'm going to be doing an internship with a law school professor for an arbitration tribunal this coming year, because that's going to be a much easier sell? And he said, absolutely, that will be true. So that was our whole conversation, the one block to my subway, and then I had my speech from my partner, and he granted me the leave of absence. And then over the course of the year, when I worked at the Beth Din of America, I was made the unofficial assistant director, and then Rabbi Boyd decided to go back to Emory at the end of the year. And I was having such a good time. I changed all the stationery and I made myself director.
Good morning. I'm Jordana Mondro. I serve as the administrative attorney at the Beth Din of America. So I'm really in charge of following cases from inception to resolution, hopefully. I got involved in the Beth Din. I guess it's a long story. I started in Jewish communal work when I was 16, when I went to the Ukraine on an NCSY program and decided that I wanted to dedicate my life to the Jewish community. Before law school, I worked in Jewish communal service. First, I attended Yeshiva University's graduate program for women in advanced Talmudic studies. Then I flew out to LA to join an outreach kollel with my husband, and I ran a collegiate women's learning program there and taught in Eula Girls High School, and then came back to the East Coast, decided that I wanted to pursue Jewish history, a master's in Revel, worked at SAR, and then decided to go to law school. And when the job came up at the VDA, it seemed like the perfect way to integrate Jewish communal work and law.
Right, let me just say the code for this session is HABLE. To go with Avi's chair. So that's a code for people online. The first question I'll direct to Rabbi Weissman. I understand one of the areas in which, or one of the functions you perform at the Beth Din is to choose Dayanim for the various cases. I guess my question is, what are the most important qualities of a Dayan? And how much thought is given to, in terms of balancing overall quality of the Dayan? We only use quality Dayanim, but how much is specific knowledge with respect or specific experience with respect to a particular controversy or area of law, how much is that taken into account when trying to choose the Dayanim for a particular controversy?
So we have a roster of about a dozen, maybe 15 Dayanim that we pull from on a regular basis. And they really run the gamut in terms of their expertise and background. Some of them are pure Talmidei Chachamim who have expertise in Choshei Mishpat and experience in sitting on panels. Some of them have spent time in Israel on panels as Dayanim and gotten their shimush there. Some of them come from our own Yadin Yadin Kohel here at Yeshiva University and are, you know, really their expertise lies in Choshen Mishpat. On the other end of the gamut, we have some Dayanim who really don't have much formal affiliation or familiarity with Choshen Mishpat, with the Jewish laws of monetary law, but they have experience either in the marketplace as accountants or businessmen, or experience as lawyers. They've attended law school, they've practiced law, and then you kind of have the Dayanim who kind of fit in the middle, where they have both Choshen Mishpat expertise and legal expertise. So, for example, you know, Rabbi Reese is someone, as you just heard, is someone who practiced he's a graduate of Yale Law School, he practiced in a law firm, but he also is an expert in Choshen Mishpat. Rabbi Danny Rapp, who you heard from earlier, is a Columbia Law grad who sits here in Yeshiva for most of his time, and so he has a Choshen Mishpat background. I have a similar background. We have a few Dayanim who kind of fit that description. But I think all three of those categories of Dayanim and everything in between all contribute in a really important way to our ability to professionally and expertly hear and decide the cases that come in front of us. And typically, on any given case, we'll have a mixture of that secular legal expertise, that marketplace experience, as well as the Choshen Mishpat expertise as well. And that's important because very often, even in cases that might turn exclusively on Choshen Mishpat, you kind of need to know what's going on in the marketplace, the expectations of the parties, in order to adequately arrive at a Jewish law answer to a question. We have a concept in Halacha of Kol Tanai Sheva Mamon Kayim, which means that parties are free to contract, generally speaking, to whatever contractual terms they wish to. And so even though there's a baseline halacha that's set forth in the Talmud and in the codes in Shulchan Aruch, very often the actual answer to a case, the actual way we'll actually decide the case, might not fit squarely within a siman in Choshen Mishpat, but because it reflects what's called minhag ha-sochrim, the customs of the marketplace, the expectations that parties who engage in commerce in the marketplace have. And so it's important to have that expertise. It's also important because if part of the Din Torah turns on a 50-page partnership agreement, you need to know how to flip that partnership agreement, how to look at the right provisions, to know how to issue spot and to know what issues are in play in order to get at the right decision. So I think one of the unique features of the Beth Din of America as compared to other Batei Din is this multiplicity of expertise, this diversity of expertise that informs the panels that sit on our cases.
The next question is for Rabbi Reese. Rabbi Reese, we know you've sat on a number of Batei Din, and when sitting back and formulating the Psak Halacha, is the Beis Din's goal to simply resolve the narrow issue in front of them between the parties? Is it to set halachic precedent like we have in United States court, that the different decisions have precedential value? Is it also maybe to set communal expectations, communal values? What goes through your head, if anything, other than resolving the narrow dispute between the two parties in front of you?
The main thing that goes through my head is the responsibility of Dayanim to be done din emes la'amito, that when we decide a case, we have to decide fairly and justly and thoroughly and responsibly with respect to the parties, that we have certain parties who are in front of us, and we represent the divine presence, as it were, and we have a solemn responsibility to satisfy their needs, to understand their circumstances, to understand the entire background of the case, to figure out all of the halachic angles and applicable laws, and also to determine what are the relevant practices of the contemporary commercial marketplace that may need to be integrated into our halachic analysis, to make sure that we gather extensive evidence and testimony and that we leave no stone unturned, And in the process of doing that, to really gain an understanding of the entire framework of this type of case, which obviously will serve us well in the future as well, when we have to consider similar type situations and cases and litigations that come in front of us. So I would say that primarily our focus is on the parties, but secondarily, one of the side benefits of doing a very thorough job and really gaining an understanding of the entire framework of the dispute is to be able to have some sort of a precedent that we can draw upon for the future.
Again, the code for this session is table. It wasn't so clear. And the last one was chair. This is a question from the audience, and it could be whoever wants to answer may answer. Is there any prohibition on someone that was a dayan to serve as an attorney for a party in the Beis Din of America, obviously on a different case? If it is allowed, how would it be handled?
I think the question is there a prohibition on someone who's previously served as a dayan to represent the party in front of the Beis Din of America? I would say, generally speaking, the dayanim who sit on cases are not people who are engaged in the active practice of law. I think that's pretty much true across the board. And I think we'd be very reluctant to find ourselves in a position where there's a attorney advocating for a party where that attorney just recently sat on as a dayan on the case. I can't think of any situation where that's happened in recent memory. And I think we'd be reluctant to allow it to happen. The challenge that we sometimes run into in terms of handling these types of questions is that we have to be careful as an arbitration body in order to ensure the enforceability of our decisions, not to in any way curtail someone's right to effective counsel. And so, you know, we kind of sometimes when we handle these kind of conflict questions, it's a double-edged sword, because no matter which way we go, we kind of run up against some legal doctrine that's set up to cause us problems in dealing with a challenging situation like that. But I think for the most part, the way we handle this is by not having dayanim who are actively engaged in representing parties. And that's why it's worked out well, and that we haven't really faced that challenge.
A question for Jordana. Jordana, you mentioned that you are the primary case administrator of the at the Beis Din of America, so you're in direct contact with the parties on a regular basis. If you could describe the role of lawyers in the Beis Din process, with whom you interface on a regular basis, do you find their role to be constructive, destructive? How could it be more, given that there are lawyers here, how can they be more constructive in assisting the Beis Din? And what, if any, no-nos have you come across when dealing with lawyers for litigants in front of the Beis Din?
So actually, at the Beis Din of America, we probably have half the cases where parties are represented and half where parties represent themselves pro se. There are pros and cons to each of those case narratives. And especially as an administrator, there are challenges in both of those situations. I definitely encounter a lot of attorneys who have never had any exposure to Beis Din. And my job as the administrative attorney is to walk parties and attorneys through the process of the Beis Din, through our arbitration process, possibly mediation process. Some specific challenges. Obviously, when parties represent themselves pro se, their expectations are quite unrealistic of how the process works. Lawyers are a little bit more realistic in terms of the time frame we're talking about. We try to be really efficient. Once parties sign an arbitration agreement, we're able to usually schedule a hearing within 2, maybe 3 weeks of signing the arbitration agreement. And that's fast if you're working in the world of American courts. But for parties representing themselves, that's never fast enough. So in that way, having attorneys on board, it makes my job easier because they're able to make their parties more aware of what real expectations are. Though sometimes attorneys do complicate matters because sometimes they are the ones who are prolonging the process. And they know enough to, especially, let's say, an attorney for a respondent in a case who, from the beginning, doesn't really want to come to Beit Din and sort of dragging their feet. When you have an attorney involved, they just become more efficient at dragging their feet and prolonging matters. I do usually, and sometimes we do have cases where one side is represented by an attorney and one side is not. And sometimes those are the hardest cases for me to administer and see through because, again, there's just a discrepancy between, you know, skills and tactics. But really, it's the tactics. You know, if somebody's representing themselves pro se, they don't know, you know, to necessarily request an adjournment and keep on requesting an adjournment in a certain matter that will, you know, we're going to keep on having to reschedule the case, and it's going to go on and on. So as attorneys, I would just impart to you to, you know, please practice, I guess, you know, transparently. It's hard, you know, attorneys have, they can just be more, I'm not sure, I don't want to use a negative word, more tactfully. Yes.
Thank you, Trina.
I'll ask you a question now, and then you also.
Okay. Just for clarification, we're getting a lot of more emails about the codes than about questions. So the codes for the first two sessions was chair. So the first session was chair, the second session was chair, this session is table. Rabbi Rosenzweig, first a plug for Jewish Prudence. I think it's a wonderful, I really commend everyone to sign up for it. It's an excellent read, and it's short, and it's punchy, and you learn a lot from it. I was looking at, this is a general question about maybe like technology and the evolving mores of halacha. In your December 23rd issue of Jurisprudence, you talk about hodas bal din, admissions by parties, and the difference between the way halacha treats written admissions versus spoken admissions, where written admissions are given more, have more of an impact given the solemnity in which people write. What jumped off the page when I read that was, is that true today, given emails, given texts, given WhatsApps? In fact, it might just be the opposite, that today people are more, unfortunately, like liberal in their written word than they are in the spoken word. And something like that, how would you, sitting as a dayan, and likely the youngest dayan and the most technologically savvy dayan, deal with an issue like that? Like an admission, this isn't a particular case, that admission over WhatsApp that's technically perhaps in writing, but doesn't comport with the other standards of solemnity that that the poskim were talking about when distinguishing between written and spoken admissions. And you could use that as a springboard for anything related. Thank you.
So I think the question betrays two facts. The first is that you don't fully appreciate Rabbi Weissman's technological savvy. He's clearly more technological savvy than I am. The second is that you don't read the footnotes on Jurisprudence.
Guilty as charged.
Because the last footnote on that post raises the question, right? What would you do with a written admission that straddles the line between what you'd call like a solemn admission? You have a loan document in the hands of the creditor. The halacha clearly would take that as a binding admission of liability. Casual oral admissions, the halacha looks at more skeptically. I think as to your question about what do you do with a WhatsApp or an email correspondence, it would really depend on the context. After that post, I think Professor Broyd emailed me and he said, you know, it's an interesting point, the halacha doesn't really seem to draw a clear line between written admissions per se as ontologically different from oral ones. It seems to be more of a question of how serious was the person in making the admission. And there's a general presumption in halacha that a written one would be made more seriously because the creditor now has it as a piece of evidence that he could hold against the borrower. But that's another good example of where somebody who's just learning in a Beis Medrash and you want to know what's the underlying principle in Hodas Baal Din, you want to look at a contemporary case of how is this principle applied for these in-between cases where it's written but doesn't quite have the same formality as a formal document. I just want to briefly respond to two of the earlier comments. I have that permission to do so. So just to respond to the question that was put to Ray Weissman about the qualities of Dayanim, I just want to point out a lot of it's also the combination and the dynamics of the panel. Especially because you have a broad range of Dayanim, you want to make sure that Dayanim could work together and deliberate on the case together. So you could imagine a case where you have one Dayan who's an expert in Chush and Mishpat, and then you could have another Dayan who's, let's say, an expert in hedge funds or other kinds of investments, and you'll say, well, look, these are, or you could have an expert in a certain area of law, and the non-expert in halacha will say, well, look, this is what it looks like from my perspective, but this is the Beis Din of America, we defer to halacha, so I'll defer to whatever the halacha says about it. That could be problematic, and it would undermine the point of having different voices on the panel if one person is so ready to abdicate his position to another member on the panel. So a lot of it is the dynamics of the panel more than the individual expertise of the Dayanim. And just to respond to the question that was raised to Jordana about lawyers in the courtroom, so I'm a bit of an exception when it comes to this question. Most of my colleagues would say that to have Toanim, rabbinic advocates, or even non-rabbinic advocates, it's not necessarily good for the process. Chaim mentioned how halacha is skeptical about lawyers putting arguments forward for the parties. And it's true that from a certain perspective, that does seem to be the halacha's position. But from a different perspective, you can imagine the following two scenarios. You could have a case that's argued pro se by a party. He or she comes into the bez and they say, here's a narrative, here are the facts of the case, this is what happened. Do justice and make me whole. But that puts a huge burden on the Dayanim now to try to figure out what exactly the legal arguments are and under what bases and under what principles of halacha the claimant wants to collect. So if you don't have lawyers making the arguments for the party, usually you'll just get a narrative, a list of grievances, and now the Dayanim have to sit down and say, oh, the party meant that this is a claim under a principle of tort. Or no, this is a claim under a principle of contract. This is a claim under conferring benefits. So it puts a greater burden on the Dayanim, and it takes control of the case out of the parties. Because they're just telling you a story, and then the Dayanim have the wide discretion to decide what principles actually apply. Take the other extreme. You have an attorney who's well-versed in American law that walk into the Beis Din of America where the rules say that, to a certain extent, halacha is going to be applied, but you could also have a choice of law clause. If the case is only argued from the point of view of American law, the Dayanim might say, well, those are interesting arguments from American law, but there's a clear aspect of halacha that applies, in which case the legal arguments don't really bear on the ultimate decision. So one way where I think there's a need for a very important middle ground is to have lawyers or attorneys who are well-versed in the halachic arguments of the case, who could then put forward those arguments and allow the Dayanim to weigh in on the merits of the arguments between the different attorneys. I'm not sure that field of expertise is sufficiently robust and sufficiently regulated in order for it to be efficient, but at least theoretically, I think that's where an important area of a Beis Din jurisprudence could be efficiently improved.
One of the questions from the audience, and I'll leave it to the panel to decide who will answer, is do the parties in front of the Beis Din of America, do they have any role in selecting the Dayanim? Typically, do they, you know, is there a zabla? Is there a ability to strike any Dayanim? Does each one party get a certain amount of peremptory challenges? Or is it just within the sole discretion of the Beis Din to appoint the three Dayanim absent any conflicts?
Typically, our protocol is for the Beis Din of America to have full control over in paneling a panel of three or even a single arbitrator, a single Dayan, for all the reasons that we just heard when we spoke about the dynamics of the panel and expertise. On the panel, it's much more comfortable for us to feel comfortable with our panel. But there definitely are instances where the parties have negotiated either before signing an arbitration agreement or after. Sometimes it's even an added custom clause in an arbitration agreement where they've decided amongst themselves, we provide a list of our panel, and from our panel they've chosen, let's say one party wanted to choose one, another party wanted to choose another, and then we still would retain control over choosing that third. Especially because our protocol also is in the panel of three dayanim, to always have one of the dayanim also be an attorney. So some of our dayanim are attorneys and some of them are not. So in a way, that's a zabla. So the parties have agreed to come to the Beit Din of America, but they have negotiated that they have some control over the chosen dayanim. We have also, though, even we've tried to avoid typical zablas, and zablas are in a situation where, let's say, one party, you know, approaches the Beit Din of America. We send a hazmana on the party's behalf, a summons, and the other party, the respondent who gets that hazmana, doesn't want to come to the Beit Din of America, and it is their halachic right to choose another Beit Din to transfer the case to. But sometimes, if we have working relationships with some batei din, and sometimes if the respondent chooses one of those batei din, we can actually create a panel and a zabla where we're drawing from both of the batei din. And ideally, we would want that to happen under the auspices of the Beit Din of America so that our rules and procedures are still in place. Because in other batei din, we're not exactly positive all the time of what their rules and procedures are and how they view ex parte communication, especially. That's the biggest danger and risk of going to a zabla or to another Beit Din, where you may have parties that are communicating one-on-one with one or more of the dayanim, not in the absence of the other party.
Okay. We're getting a lot of questions now. One question was, are the proceedings transcribed in the Beit Din America? The answer is yes.
Recorded,
right. There is a record of the proceedings. A number of questions about appeal. Is there an appeal mechanism in the Beit Din of America? The answer is, well, Rabbi Weissman, do you want to talk about the
Yes, one of the other things that's unique about the Beit Din of America is that in our rules and procedures, section 31 of our rules and procedures provides for an appeal mechanism where you can challenge a decision rendered by the Beit Din. There's a set of enumerated bases for challenging a decision. Some of them track the New York CPLR, such as a mistake in calculation or a mistaken description of property. But the last category is a mistake in Jewish law. So if you feel that the dayanim got it wrong, simply speaking, you can appeal within 10 days in writing. The appeal process takes place within 20 days. Thank you. Within 20 days of the issuance of the decision, the appeal process takes place in writing by written briefs submitted by the parties. And then the briefs are, together with the underlying decision, are reviewed by the Av Beis Din. Typically, the Av Beis Din will delegate it to someone else. Rabbi Reis, these days, is usually our go-to delegee of appeal decisions. And so Rabbi Reis has penned a number of appeal decisions recently and over the years. But that's something I think that's unique, fairly unique among batei din. Other batei din, at least in North America, do not feature an appeal process. It's another way that we kind of check ourselves and make sure we get the right answer.
A question about dissenting opinions. Is there such a thing as a dissenting opinion in the Beis Din world? Are those opinions published? Are they shared with the parties? Are they somehow incorporated into the Beis Din's psak? Either Rabbi Rosenzweig or Rabbi Reis?
Yeah.
I think the practice over the years at the Beth Din of America has been to try to reach a consensus. That's one of the values of having three different judges sitting on the cases, that they can confer with each other, they can benefit from each other's insights, and often they will reach a happy medium in terms of fashioning a decision that at the end of the give and take, they are all satisfied is the most just and proper and accurate decision for all of the parties. So by and large, there really have not been any dissents. I can remember one case where there was a very strong disagreement that one dayan had with the other two dayanim regarding the scope of the applicability of dina d'malchus dina, but just how far you extend the principle that the law of the land can be sometimes incorporated into the halakhic decision. The two of the dayanim felt Dina de Malchusa was appropriate in a particular case, and the third dayan felt that it wasn't and really didn't want to sign off on the decision. According to the rules of the Beth Din of America, as long as you have a majority ruling in a particular direction, that's sufficient. So therefore, it was good enough to have the two judges who were prepared to sign on the dotted line, but the other judge did sign as well, but signed in a dissenting format. If all of the judges agree that they're comfortable expressing who ruled one way and who ruled the other way, so then that can be permitted under Jewish law, as long as it's not one judge just whispering in somebody's ear after a decision has been issued, oh, I really only came around because of the other two. So that would be a violation of what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says would be a transgression of Rechilus. But if everybody's in agreement, so then that can be done. And then that case would probably be more likely to be appealed if one of the parties sees that there was a judge who actually dissented in favor of their losing position. But by and large, the Beth Din does have a good track record of being able to reach a consensus. We had a case in Chicago at the Chicago Rabbinical Council where there was a disagreement regarding one or two of the different issues that had to be considered by the Beth Din. So we ruled on maybe 10 or 11 issues, but there were one or two where there was a disagreement and the judges didn't reach a consensus, but the format that we decided to use in that case, it could also be considered, was, as the Gemara says, instead of identifying which judges ruled one way and which ruled another, we made it clear that there wasn't a complete consensus. We followed majority rule. The Gemara uses a phrase, midivreihem nizdak eploni, that from the total deliberations of the judges, this was the result. So that was the phrase that we used in our decision, and we gave the various source references so the parties could understand what that really meant.
Okay, we're running out of time. We're actually over. So let's have a lightning round. Are Beis Din proceedings, are they confidential? Are they open to the public as in civil courts, or is it just between the litigants? Can the litigants bring whomever they want and so on?
Our proceedings are confidential. Our rules and procedures provide that there's no one allowed in the room other than the parties and their counsel themselves. And so that's one of the distinctions, differences between arbitration and court litigation, is that the matter is confidential. One of our biggest challenges, actually, in terms of selling to the public our professionalism and our competence is the issue of confidentiality. We'd love to publish decisions more than we do. One of the reasons why we created Jewish Prudence was to, as a platform for publishing decisions, but we've adopted a policy of only publishing decisions after anonymizing them and after getting the consent of the parties. And what we found is that even if you anonymize the decisions very much, parties are very reluctant to give permission to publish. So this is a plea to former and future litigants to please give us permission to publish decisions once they're anonymized. But that's one of our challenges we have. But it reflects our promise of confidentiality in the cases that we hear.
Do we have time for more? Or?
Okay.
So many good questions. There's a quick one. Is there any panels with more than three dayanim?
No.
No. Done. Okay. See, that was
it. Yeah. As long as it's an odd number.
If the Bezin does the Chalitza, so then there are three judges and right. two additional judges on the side.
Additionally, does the Bezin accept expert testimony from the parties on in any circumstance?
Sometimes you will hear expert testimony. Usually it pertains to the facts of the case or to the custom in the industry. Actually, one thing that we've been discussing is that a way to solve the earlier problem, if parties come in and they're not allowed to have rabbinic advocates, how could they present their case based on halachic principles? One possible solution is that they can maybe call an expert witness who would then give some color to the halachic arguments, even if that witness is not serving as an advocate for the party.
Isn't that just a towing by another name?
In that case?
Yeah. I mean, which is another question that was presented, is that why is there, I know Tohanim are universally disfavored, but as Rabbi Rosenzweig, as you described, courts and arbitration panels routinely accept briefs from the various litigants on the state of the law and how the law should be applied to the facts of the case. You've now made a number of comments that I think indicate that you would be amenable, if not would welcome, the same type of analysis by a halachic expert. Why then are Tohanim disfavored in the Beis Din of America?
I'll refer to the relevant chapter in my book, Kanfei Yonah, where I talk about the role of lawyers and Tohanim in Beit Din proceedings. There's a long literature about the appropriateness of having rabbinic advocates in front of Beit Din. One of the major problems with respect to rabbinic advocates, in addition to the fact that it's very difficult to find halakhic precedent for allowing such a thing, especially when the parties are able to present their cases themselves, is that at least in the Beis Din world here in the United States, we don't have any kind of licensing or regulation of rabbinic advocates. So there would be nothing, for example, that would stop somebody who serves as a rabbinic advocate from switching sides in the middle of the case if the other side makes a better offer. In fact, this is something that's even discussed in the halakhic literature. So there could be practices that are just objectively problematic and unethical that can take place in terms of what the rabbinic advocates will end up doing. And because of the fact that it's not a regulated industry, so therefore it almost encourages those who are practitioners to go to the lowest common denominator in order to be zealous advocates on behalf of their clients. If we could develop some sort of a system here in the United States similar to what they have in Eretz Yisrael, where there are rabbinic advocates, but they're very carefully regulated, and just like the attorneys here are regulated, licensed, there are rules of professional conduct, which if violated could cause a lawyer to be suspended or to lose their license and credentials. If we had something similar, so then it could be considered. But even then, it would have to be considered according to the parameters of halakha, where it's really the job of the judges, it's the job of the dayanim to determine how to apply Jewish law to the facts at hand, and not for rabbinic advocates to try to skew or manipulate the principles of halakha in favor of their clients.
Unfortunately, we have lots of additional questions, but we have to stop giving Rabbi Willig's presentation. The panelists will be circulating if you want to ask them anything. Thank you very much for your attention.